You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon, Spokane. As I said, you're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, Thin Air Community Radio. You may be listening online at kyrs.org, and you may be listening in your car or anywhere else. So thanks for listening wherever you are. I'm your host, Taylor. I should start the show by saying that Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories. 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. Thanks so much for joining me today on the show. It's the first time I've been on my own in the studio for quite a while. I've been having great guests. I'm going to continue that and really expand that through this month. That being said, as we get into the show today, I am going to play a talk from someone else, from Terry Rose, that you'll hear more about in a minute. Other than that, I'd love to take some calls if you're open to that. Let's wait until I dive into what the topic material, the subject matter is, but when it is time, you can write this down for the future. The number to call is 747-3807. I'm really looking to incorporate some more calls now that I have this awesome weekend time slot. It's no longer a Monday morning, you know, sneaking around your boss at work kind of situation. So if you are a normal listener to Praxis, you probably know that I'm dedicating the whole month of November to the topic of education. The whole show, in some ways, even the title of the show, Praxis, is a nod to education and making sure that we're learning, we're putting our ideas, we're testing them out in the world and evaluating them and seeing whether they work. And that's kind of what learning is all about if you're doing it scientifically. And my original vision for this month, which the scheduling didn't work out, was to start with the topic today. Today's topic is going to be about babies and very young people, infants, toddlers, and the ways that they learn, their brain development, and how that's hindered and changed by trauma, what trauma is, what are the drivers of it in our society, and how it affects learning, and how we can help overcome that when it's already happened. But really, more along the lines of this show, wanting to talk about radical systems change, how we can prevent it from happening in the first place. So I'm really excited to talk about that. I meant to go from here, go kind of chronologically, start with early childhood, like I'm about to today, then move to secondary education, elementary, middle, high school, then move to higher ed, then talk about adults, and then do a big where do we go from here kind of show. Ended up not working that way scheduling wise. So last week, if you listened into the show, Kenny Barney, a good friend of mine who's working on his master's in adult ed, came and talked with me and we had a great talk. Next week, I'm putting together a panel that should be really interesting, local and non-local, recent, meaning last 5 years, college grads to talk about. You know, we hear a lot of like waxing poetic about our generation, but I'd really like to get it from the horse's mouth, as it were. So I'm going to get a panel together, different disciplines. I have some scientists, I have some humanities people, I have some education people, artists who have all recently completed their education. And we're just going to check in and see where they're at. Are they saddled with crushing debt? Are they working in their chosen field? Are they adrift in the world? So I'm really excited for that because it'll be a lot of friends of mine and we'll be able to dive into that. I'm hoping to do a similar panel the following week with high school students in different alternative programs and in traditional high school. We have a program of high school students. I might engage some of the Raise Your Voice people in that and just talk about that, how hard it is sometimes to get the big institutions of education to be flexible and to be able to pivot and follow. Really, I mean, a lot of times follow what the research says we should be doing for learning, rather than stick with these traditional modes because it's what we've been using. Treating kids like data points hasn't really been working in the ways we need it to. So that's a lot of what Kenny and I talked about last week. You can check that out and all other past shows and today's show after tomorrow sometime on the podcast archive. You can find that link at kyrs.org under programs, Praxis, or you can go straight to praxisradio509.podomatic.com. So, all the housekeeping out of the way, you know we're talking about education, early childhood specifically. And this idea, I've done a lot of training and learning on this, and I thought I'd just start with a little overview, because we might all have different ideas of what trauma means. It might be considered something more extreme than it really is. We're looking at a huge proportion of students and children in this country, not to mention other parts of the world that are in much more dramatic, high-stress, trauma-inducing situations like war, like war primarily. But even poverty, all kinds of situations in the U.S., domestic abuse, there's a big proportion of kids who are dealing with some kind of trauma. And basically, this is from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, their basic definition, this is what we're operating on today when we talk about it. They say a traumatic event is a sudden and unexpected occurrence that causes intense fear and may involve a threat of physical harm or actual physical harm. A traumatic experience may have a profound effect on the physical health, mental health, and development of the student. So that's a traumatic event. There's also ongoing, a series of these traumatic events, which can be anything from, you know, it's often related to parental stress, which is often related to poverty, which is something we're going to talk about a lot. And sometimes it's not directly poverty related. So there's a lot of reactions to this that we'll hear about. I'm mostly going to let Terry Rose do the work on that, because she gives a really beautiful TED Talk about this that's just more eloquent than I can be on this topic. So what we know is that a huge proportion, unfortunately, experience trauma on some level. It changes the way that it changes the neural mapping of your brain, which is really what we're going to be looking at, ways that that can be done and undone. The stress creates, you know, the stress early in life creates the patterns that are going to be followed in the brain and in the body beyond that. So how can we avoid those situations in the first place? How can we intervene after that's already happened? And most importantly, probably, how can we have empathy for these kids rather than treating them like a problem? That's really the school system in general. That's, I'd say, a fair characterization of what happens with these kids. And especially as they get older, if there's untreated or ongoing trauma, or it hasn't been addressed effectively early on, as Terry Rose says in this TED Talk we're going to play in just a minute, it's a lot harder for many adults to empathize with a 17-year-old who seems adult in so many ways, in the way that we would with a 4 or 5-year-old who's just gone through a traumatic experience. So we see the ways this plays out in communities that have multi-generational poverty, that have deep poverty, mass incarceration, and even somewhere like, you know, quaint Spokane, we have a lot of kids growing up without what they need, whether that's a physical needs of enough food, nourishment, or whether it's emotional needs, positive relationships with adults, all that stuff. So I'm going to let Terry Rose kick it off here, because, as I said, she does a great job. This is a TEDx talk that she gave in 2011. Here's the introduction from them. Looking for solutions to the yawning achievement gap for children in poverty, Terry Rose sees the path of success through the eyes of babies. So this is actually called From the Baby's Point of View. She talks about what she calls toxic stress. That's this ongoing trauma that I'm talking about. It's called different things in different contexts. But she talks about that very well. So I'm just going to share it with you right now. And then be glad to take some calls in the second half of the show. You can always chime in on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio. And I'm glad to hear your thoughts during Education Month on Praxis. So here goes. Enjoy. And I'll be back to talk a little bit more about this and hopefully get to some solution points and some more analysis after this. So this is Terry Rose from the baby's point of view.
Frequently I get asked how I started on the path that I'm on and the inspiration. And perhaps like many of you, there were moments where my professional work and my personal work life came together. I remember this October day as I was driving our three children from the grocery store to the pumpkin patch. And in the back seat were our three-year-old, our one-and-a-half-year-old, and our baby. And as I drove for my Martha Stewart moment at the pumpkin patch, tears were rolling down my cheeks. Physically and emotionally exhausted, living by my own standards of parenting, these three very closely spaced children. At the time, I was working on a research project as a statistician for a home visiting intervention that was looking at helping women who were using drugs and alcohol during pregnancy improve their parenting. I remember one day watching this woman with a three-year-old by her side push a double stroller over the snow-covered sidewalks of Minneapolis and convince her three-year-old to walk the two blocks to catch the bus. Now, I knew my job was impossible. And I had an attached garage, a supportive spouse, an amazing community, and a PhD in child development. I actually used to go to parent education classes, not telling anybody what my background was, just so I could have coffee with the ladies. In fact, I was terrible during parent-child interaction time because I did not want to play with my children. One day, one of the women pulled me aside and she says, "What do you do? You sound a little bit like my therapist." I had been outed in parent education class. We also have been on a journey in terms of policy, research, and practice. And I'd like to borrow from an urban legend to talk about this journey. It's this a day a villager is out walking alongside a river. And as he's looking at the current, seeing the sun glisten upon the water, he notices something in the river. And he realizes it's a child. And without regard for himself, he jumps into the river, he pulls that child ashore, and he calls for another villager to come down to help him. As she walks down and wraps her sweater around the two of them, she too notices a child in the river and jumps in and pulls that child ashore. Well, they lived in a very prosperous, very generous village, and soon they had people lined up on lookout because these children kept coming down the river. There were folks responsible for taking care of the rescuers and the children and supplies. Everyone had a job to do. One day, one of the villagers started walking away from her position. They're like, "Hey, where are you going?" "I'm going to find out why the children are in the river in the first place." That's actually the journey that we've been on for about the last 50 years. Our first vision was that we saw children living in poverty, particularly those in families relying on welfare, who are not as well prepared for school as children coming from more affluent communities. And so we created Head Start. In the 80s, we saw the importance of parent-child relationships, and so we started home visiting as a way of helping improve parent education and understanding of their children's cues and signals. In the 90s, we thought if we got involved with children earlier before problems happen, early intervention or prevention, maybe we could keep those problems from surfacing. And in the 90s, we got really issues focused. So we now have literacy-based early intervention home visiting programs in Head Start. The problem is, part of what we did is we took what we knew at the wide end of the river and we just miniaturized it. A first grade classroom started to look like a preschool classroom, started to look like an infant classroom. So that in this infant classroom, you have an area for climbing and an area for reading, as if a baby would know they needed to do those things in two different spots. The other thing we've done is there's been a major change in the fabric of lives of families living in poverty, and that was welfare reform. We now, all of the interventions we've developed previously, relied on a parent being home for most of the time, even in communities of poverty. Now we've said young mothers in poverty need to be working, and there needs to be a place for those children to go during the day. But in most communities of poverty, there is no high-quality place for those babies to be, for the families still to be nurtured. In fact, the Minnesota Children's Defense Fund reports that children under the age of two have more changes in who takes care of them during a week than any other age group, than a 6-year-old, than a 12-year-old. At a time where relationships are so critical, children are going from adult to adult to adult. Now, if you journey with me back downstream, this well-organized village, this is our special education system. We are spending all kinds of resources. Everybody knows in which line to stand, which form to fill out, how many minutes to be in that line. We can't even get all the children back to shore, so we've built barges out there in the middle of the river. Our juvenile justice system, our level 5 special education system, that's for the children who have been in the water for so long that it's changed the way they move, changed the way they think, changed the way they interact. The best we can hope for is to keep them dry, but we never get back to typical development. So what's the answer? Well, I'd like you to journey with me today upstream and do something really important. Turn 180 degrees and begin to look at the river from the baby's point of view. The lovely part is that there's this grassy meadow of typical development right before that child. The early experiences that that baby has are what form the neural synapses, the connections that are made that lay the foundation for that child's growth and development. A mom has her baby in a bouncy seat as she cooks dinner. She twirls the toy bar, the baby gets interested in it, gets a little fussy, and she's like, oh, I'm stirring the pot. Baby gets a little more fussy, she realizes the baby's not going to be distracted, she picks him up, he calms back down. It's nothing extraordinary. It's everything ordinary, paying attention to the cues and signals, what the baby's learning about forming relationships, regulating his emotions, and learning through play and exploration. Contrast that for a minute to a baby that spends all of his day in a saucer. His mother and father are diagnosed with schizophrenia. The best they can do is keep that baby safe, but relying on him, his cues and signals to get fed, no luck. Has to do with when the parents remember, monitoring who interacts with that baby by virtue of their mental illness, who comes in and out of that house is unregulated. Sometimes the baby's bombarded, sometimes left alone. Those everyday experiences are forming the architecture of each of those babies' brains. Now I want to pull back a little bit from something quite so dramatic and talk about those babies that are beginning to get into the river. Right on the pebbly shore. I want to tell you a story about Joe. Joe's parents were expecting the birth of their baby, their second baby, and they had decided that they wanted to spend the first week just at home with the new baby, mom, dad, and the new baby. And Joe would go with grandma and grandpa, who he loved very much, and they had all kinds of fun things planned. He had a present a day to open so he could remember when he was going home. Joe comes home after the 7 days. He's home with his new baby, his mom and dad. That night, in the middle of the night, while Joe's asleep, the baby spikes 105 temperature. Mom, dad, and the baby are air-vac'd from their rural community to a teaching hospital 3 hours away. Joe wakes up in the morning to a neighbor. The next night, he's at the aunt and uncle's house. The next night, at another neighbor's house. The baby's diagnosis was spinal meningitis. Fortunately, the baby recovered. 2.5 weeks later, Joe, mom, and dad, and the baby come home. Joe is cranky, irritable, not sleeping through the night. He wants to be held all the time. Dad's been out of work for 3 weeks. Mom has this critically ill baby. Now, if Joe was running a fever, was cranky, not sleeping through the night, and pulling at his ear, she'd call her family practitioner and say, I think Joe has an ear infection. Can I bring him in? What does she do in this case when he's showing symptoms? Ideally, this has been a family practice or a pediatric office that has been screening for social emotional health right along with motor development, with vision, so that she knows she can call and say, I think Joe's having some difficulty. Can somebody get us some help? They could be connected with a mental health provider who probably would see the family 2 or 3 times. They'd make a plan for Joe in transitions. They'd help him understand, go ahead and hold him, because as soon as he knows you're not going to leave anymore, he won't want to be held anymore. He's 2.5 years old. Could you have a babysitter come over 1 hour a day to take care of the baby, because we know you're worried about her, and you just spend an hour with Joe? A couple times, Joe's back on the path of typical development. It's much like an ear infection. unfortunately for Joe and his family. They told me this story when he was 5 years old. He'd been kicked out of 2 childcare centers. There was no such help. It's interesting. With ear infections, children's anatomy changes so that they're only vulnerable to ear infections when they're very young. And we treat it because reoccurring ear infections lead to later hearing loss. But we don't treat social-emotional problems. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that 1 in 4 adults every year has symptoms of mental health problems. We need to make sure that health is more than growth, that health includes social-emotional development. How does that baby go about forming relationships? How does that baby experience and regulate their emotion? And how do they learn? Now, we have some children who are particularly vulnerable to something that we have been calling toxic stress. 3 things make up toxic stress. The first one is deep poverty, the lack of opportunity. The second one is child maltreatment or neglect. And the third one is trauma. Trauma can be witnessing violence. It can be experiencing an environmental event like a hurricane or a tornado without a supportive network of adults around that child to help them understand the experience that they're going through. The center that I started, Baby Space, is in one of these neighborhoods that has high poverty, extremely high community violence. In fact, a couple weeks ago, we were on lockdown at noon because there was shooting in the neighborhood. We were running around the building trying to find out as much information as we could so we could tell the children. We were able to let them know that there were 3 men that were arrested and no one was shot. We had to give them that information so they knew they were safe to go out to play. Imagine being 5 years old and the thing you have to worry about is if there's a shooter outside that could hurt you or somebody that you love. In the same community, a dad was murdered last year. 4 children in the family, but an entire community that found out that your dad could be murdered. So what's the solution? For us, it was about creating a child development center from the baby's point of view that really took social-emotional health as the critical factor. I want to tell you about the second day of child care for Tamara. Tamara was wheeled into the room. Dad signed her in and walked out. She sat in the stroller. She's 11 months old. Did she want out of the stroller? Picked her up, set her down? Nothing. At 11 months old, she's telling us what she expects from the world. Nothing. Dad was telling us what he expected from Tamara and from the rest of us. A couple days later, we have a teacher sitting right next to her as mom's leaving. Mom's leaving the door. The teacher has the baby's arm waving to the mom. Bye, Mom. See you later, the teacher says. But Tamara's head is turned this way, and Mom is leaving this way. And Mom walks out and goes, she doesn't care about me. Now I have an 11-month-old baby that is showing no indication that her parent is important and a parent who believes she is not. I have to tell you, in a typical child care center, this is a dream baby. She doesn't care when she gets fed. She never complains. She plays with whatever's in front of her. In our center, red flags are going up all over. We have a baby who is in the water and parents who do not know how to connect with that baby. We also know, based on research, that children in mildly stressful situations, so they brought 2-year-olds with their parent and they brought in a clown. Now, 2-year-olds and clowns don't go together very well. That's what researchers do. They bring in things kids don't like and they watch and see what happens. But these researchers knew a couple more things. They knew whether or not the children had a secure, reliable partner in the parent that was with them, or like Tamara, had a parent that was unavailable, inconsistently available, or not really there to support the child and partner. They also were neurobiological researchers, so they were particularly interested in stress responses. Now, you may hear a lot about cortisol because it's so easy for us to measure. Cortisol is that fight-or-flight, saber-tooth tiger run extra boost that we get in emergency situations. Interestingly, if children, as the clown is there, all the children look the same. I cannot eyeball who has a secure relationship, as we say in attachment research, or has an insecure relationship. Y'all look the same. But something different is happening on the neurobiological level. The children with a secure parent, a partner in the stress, no change. The children who do not have a reliable partner are kicking in your own cortisol system. Fight or flight, saber-tooth tiger, run. You're 2 years old. You're not even old enough to know saber-tooth tigers don't exist, but your body's reacting as though it does. Interestingly, if we look at math achievement later on, children who have secure early relationships with their parents do better in math than the children who did not. Now, there's no difference in ability. It's in achievement. Why? Because if I have a trusted partner, and I know that when I get stuck on a math problem, I can turn to my neighbor and say, hey, could you help me with this? Versus if I've never had a trusted partner and I get stuck on a math problem, my body is going saber-tooth tiger, saber-tooth tiger. And I never get the help I need. So by bringing innovation from the baby's point of view, this is what it looked like for Tamara. Couple months later, we're still doing wave and talk for the baby, but this time after mom left, Tamara retraced mom's steps, put her hands up on the door, turned around, and fell completely apart. She was crying. We were thrilled. Finally, what had been capped was able to bubble up. 4 months later, this is what it looks like. Mom's is hanging out in the childcare room because we have partnered mom with a parent educator in the same way we partnered Tamara with a teacher. We found out domestic violence was happening in the house. Now, for Tamara, shutting down was a great survival strategy, terrible developmental strategy. The family now has a safety plan in place. Dad is out of the home. Things are better. Mom's working on her job, and the teachers know about that. Now Tamara brings a book over to mom. They read the book together. Mom goes to leave. Tamara follows her. They give each other 3 kisses goodbye, and Tamara holds her arms up for the teacher to hold her. In 4 months, she went from the river to the solid ground where she stays today. The distance is so short here. We have the capability of changing the fabric of lives of families, which then changes the response of the community. When we begin to look at success from the baby's point of view, we have the opportunity, we have the knowledge, we just need to bring it to our most vulnerable children and invest in them early. Thank you very much.
So that was Terry Rose's TED Talk from The Baby's Point of View. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, during an entire month of shows about education. If you were listening to that whole piece, I hope you liked it as much as I did. I found it really interesting. She's an engaging talker, and she has lots of stories, which are how many of us learn, myself included. So we're talking today about early childhood, and specifically about trauma, or as Terry Rose and some other people working in this field call it, toxic stress. And a couple things I wanted to pull out of that, especially if you weren't listening to the beginning, that initial story about the kid who has this experience, this traumatic experience of his parents leaving when his baby sister is born, and then leaving again when she gets sick and being passed from caretaker to caretaker. She talks about the parent not feeling comfortable making a call related to social or emotional or mental health for a kid. And that, I just think that is a huge part of what's wrong with education in general, and also just our social systems. This taboo about mental health is really, really, really destructive from kids, little kids, as we heard in that talk, all the way up to adults. So having that be a feature of education and a feature of healthcare and a feature of just how we interact with one another, especially parentally. You know, a lot of parents aren't empowered with knowledge. Even the ones who aren't empowered with time unless they're quite wealthy at this point. I mean, we have such intense economic straits that most of us are embroiled in that it's so overwhelming to consider doing the extra learning as adults to learn how to take this baby's point of view, as she said, or to have the time to really properly, you know, feel like you're doing a good job and to live in a society that has a skewed expectation of what good is. You know, if good is to have a calm kid who does whatever you say, then some of these more destructive brain development wise strategies might work. You know, this kind of tough love mentality that really emerged in the last century and has sort of persisted through. There's always been people who don't participate in that, but this notion that, oh, your baby's just crying to manipulate you is hopefully something that's going to be more broadly rejected because of all the reasons Terry Rose just lined out in that piece. So I thought that was a really interesting aspect to hold up. And just this idea that if you're in survival mode, you don't have time to develop all of your resources, especially as your brain's developing, your body's developing, you're a baby and you have a very limited understanding of the world. But definitely there's some really interesting research regarding, you know, the ways that babies are basically the scientists of humanity. That's your most scientific phase. You're in a constant state of experimentation as you develop. You're figuring out the rules of the natural world and of your social world. And that's really where all of this comes in. If the rules of your social world are chaotic and they're not predictable, you're going to be guarded socially and you're going to be afraid of those kind of situations. You're not going to trust people, and it's going to cause a lot of difficulty later in life. So, as always on this show, my main concern is to figure out how we can avoid that harm in the first place. How can we build a society that doesn't traumatize a solid 2/3 of its children, and, you know, create a world where a friend of mine, I was just talking to her about this topic, said where you don't have to recover from your childhood. So that's the main concern. And I really think a lot of it comes back to living in real communities again. And that's, that's something that was sort of touched on here. She, Terry Rose, in that talk, is operating on the premise that we're going to have people taking care of children who aren't those people's parents. Sometimes it will be multiple people, and how can we optimize that experience? I don't think there's anything wrong with having other people help raise your children by any means, because you know, the saying it takes a village is likely very true. As someone who has not had children, it's still apparent that that's true. So how can we build those kind of relationships back? How can we build these kind of tribal bonds where you have trusted adults who can help with your kids and you're all on the same page and you're all working together, having some consistency for these kids so that they can learn to learn, so that their brains can be prepped, you know, so that those neural maps can be positive ones that can grow, that aren't stunted by this constant stress that's really breaking their ability to learn little by little. And as you know, the hopeful aspect is that in the short term, it really can be undone if people have access to these tools. So I just think about all the parents, both in poverty and not, who don't have a space like Baby Space, the place that she runs, and don't have access to these resources. It's just got to be incredibly overwhelming. So how can we make that happen? The other point I wanted to pull out of her talk that I really liked was, it was really like a throwaway comment that she made that wasn't a big part, but she talked about ability versus achievement, that that a lot of studies are measuring achievement, meaning how well students are adapted to a school system and able to succeed within its logic, rather than innate ability, those being two distinct ideas. That's something I'm sure we'll focus on more as we move into talking about secondary education, especially where metrics have become king to really, I think, the detriment of a lot of real learning. I feel really assured in saying that as a participant in that metrics-driven education system, and as part of a class that was really a guinea pig for that model, with, I think, really failed results and poor outcomes overall. So ability versus achievement was really interesting. And it's just this whole idea of taking the baby's point of view, but then continuing that on to the kid's point of view. You know, what do kids actually need? We have mountains and mountains and mountains of great science about how people thrive, what conditions allow for thriving thinking and learning. People have been studying this forever. I mean, since we've been studying each other and ourselves, this has been a huge topic, and we know how it works, but we have these institutions that are not flexible to that. And if they are flexible, they're very slow. So how can we speed this process up and, you know, quite literally save people from a fate of not being able to learn, having dysfunctional patterns going on that are totally avoidable. So I think we should do our best to eradicate avoidable harm. And I think most harm is avoidable at the end of the day. So yeah, that was Terry. I really liked that TED Talk. I'll put that link in the podcast notes so that people can check it out. I was going to share some of this long article, but I probably won't because it's long, but I will share it in the notes as well. It's a long, wordy academic research paper about this topic. You might not want me to read it aloud to you, but you may want to read it if you're really interested in this topic. So this is a shorter piece by Janelle Ross that I wanted to pull a little bit out of. It talks about so we're going to extrapolate out these babies that Terry Rose was talking about into their teenage selves. As she said, you know, having empathy for a 17-year-old, different than having empathy for a little crying baby. So this piece is called "Does Exposure to Violence and Trauma Impact Students' Education Prospects?" She's talking about higher education. So this is all part of a continuum. And here it is. This piece is from September 8th, and it's on at the National Journal. Trauma and its effect on learning got a lot of attention in Ferguson last month. Now experts say it's time to make similar efforts for young adults from violent communities to boost the nation's college graduation rates. For a 10 a.m. literature course, the conversation in Jeannie Tidgen's Massachusetts Bay Community College classroom was surprisingly animated. Her students were deep into a discussion about an essay they had read for the week when a uniform-clad campus safety officer walked into the room. Instantly, the students' body language changed. Though the officer was only there to check that required security notices and safety measures had been posted in the classroom, some students seemed to be in a state of high alert, leaning forward and watching the officer closely. Others slouched down in their seats and completely disengaged. "The change in that classroom was palpable," said Tietjen, a professor of writing and literature. "But in some ways, it did me a huge favor. We wound up having this amazing conversation about metaphor, police, what they represent to those students, and how that's telegraphed on the page. My students were reacting to their experiences with law enforcement," she continues. "For me, it was one of those moments where a big, complicated idea became really clear. Trauma shapes learning." Just over 21 million students will attend college in the U.S. this fall, and while college going has expanded rapidly and fairly consistently across all demographic groups for more than a decade, Black and Latino students have made the largest enrollment gains. Higher rates of enrollment in college have not been matched, however, by higher graduation rates. While 42.6% of white students who entered college for the first time graduated by 2011, just 20.5% of Black students and 29.2% of Latinos did the same, according to the most recent federal data. Some education experts say too many students of color arrive without the necessary academic preparation and then get little to no support from their institutions. Others insist on a need to overhaul remedial education, encourage students to take more classes, or make more classes available online. But the link between trauma and learning has remained notably absent from the college completion debate. When school leaders do seek to address the impact of trauma on their students, the interventions are usually focused on younger children. It's very easy for us to extend compassion to a five-year-old, says Christopher Blodgett, a psychologist and director of the Washington State University's Collaborative Learning for Educational Achievement and Resiliency Trauma Center. That's a mouthful. But when a 17-year-old ticks us off, disappoints us, makes what seems like clearly bad decisions, it's really hard for a lot of us to go there. So that quote I thought I shared from Terry Rose was actually from this article. So here we are reading it now. While students of all ages may act out in a classroom because of traumatic experiences, older students exhibit difficulties with focus and decision-making. As children get older, educators and other adults expect more of them in terms of self-control, ability to manage emotions, self-organize, and persist through challenges. As children grow into adolescence, we are less tolerant of struggles in these areas and more likely to blame and punish the student. Trauma-exposed teenagers and young adults do not form trusting relationships with adults or develop a sense that they can shape their lives at a time when it's important they make critical choices for themselves, says Blodgett. This combination can make trauma-exposed high school and college students less likely to attend school and to graduate. Blodgett produced the first study showing that without intervention, exposure to traumatizing experiences and environments can adversely influence how far a person's education will go. It turns out that unaddressed trauma is an even more accurate predictor of educational outcomes than race or income. With children and teens of color disproportionately growing up in low-income and violence-ridden communities, many experience a piling on that researchers call complex trauma. The student who saw a shooting on their block or heard gunfire outside their window last night may have also moved three times this year because of their family's financial problems or because dad abuses mom. So I'm going to skip forward slightly in this because it's very long. So this is about an intervention strategy for that later on. And it's about a Chicago-based charter high school called Urban Prep. So I'm just going to continue on here. We are a country of, Tim King. So Tim King is the president and CEO of Urban Prep, and that's who this quote will come from. We're a country of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, King says. If you work hard enough, you can achieve it. For a lot of people, emotions and painful experiences just don't register as something real or important. At Urban Prep, we're not part of that group. Urban Prep serves an all-Black and Afro-Latino male student body from the city's most violent neighborhoods. Teenagers are admitted via lottery. About 85% come from low-income families. King can rattle off statistics about the tiny share, less than 3%, of Black boys who in the last 5 years attended a traditional Chicago public school and ultimately graduated from college. And he is expansive on the subject of Urban Prep's longer school hours, rigorous courses, and extensive teacher-student interaction. The innovative high school seeks to boost students' social and emotional development, beginning with frank discussions about the particular challenges faced by Black men in the United States, such as the danger they may face from police as well as peers. There are conversations about how to deal with, diffuse, and when necessary, escape such situations. The school fosters a culture of second chances with consequences. Encouraging students to ask for help when they need it, and to work hard to achieve the best results and rewards the first time around. For the last 5 years, 100% of Urban Prep students have been admitted to four-year colleges. That's probably almost unique in that statistic. That's me breaking this article here, but that's for the last 5 years, 100% of Urban Prep students have been admitted to four-year colleges. During the same period, 85% or more have enrolled. As the first Urban Prep graduates pass the five-year mark in college at the end of the school year, King estimates the share of Urban Prep students who emerge with degrees will sit far ahead of the national 15.6% five-year college graduation rate for Black males. There's no easy way to articulate the relationship between collective community trauma and academic performance, says Titchin, who's also the director of the Massachusetts Bay's Center for Trauma and Learning in Post-Secondary Education. But what I find at the post-secondary level is that a lot of students have survived all sorts of things, and in becoming resilient people, their academic and social preparation for college have taken hits. So, that was a long, sorry I was coughing there, but good article by Janelle Ross. Does exposure to violence and trauma impact students' education prospects? And this is the point where it'll be interesting to break slightly and say that this education topic is very complex. It's very complex for me. So this is focused on, it's talking about trauma and it's talking about the achievement that's being sought in these traditional terms, in the idea that, you know, a four-year college is going to be the ticket to success, which is a topic we're going to explore in this forum next week, hopefully, or the week after, depending on how the scheduling works out. But so there's these overlapping ideas where there's some people like me who are more on the radical end of the spectrum who say we need to rethink most of how we do school entirely. And then when you get into these really extreme, this intervention that's being done with students suffering from trauma, you know, stability is the most important thing. So maybe a more traditional environment that encourages stability is going to be necessary before people can move to something more open, more self-directed, etc. So it's a really interesting layer to put into the conversation. And I think there's going to be a lot of contradiction in this month of talking about education, because, you know, that on some level, I'm glad that the school has 100% enrollment rate in college, you know, among this group who's very likely to die or be incarcerated before the age of 25. At the same time, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, like, well, what four-year school are they going to? Are they going to go be, you know, business majors and perpetuate some of these systems that create this trauma in the first place? Or what are they going to go do after that? What are these systems preparing people for? Are they preparing them for a world that actually exists? It's going to be a big question for when we do this higher ed panel. But it all echoes back to these earliest experiences, and especially to what happens if those experiences continue in an ongoing way. Sorry, I'm slowly losing my voice, but I think I can make it for about the next 10 minutes that we have here. So, talking about the main trauma, I guess, the main ongoing toxic stress that I've been talking about so far on the show is the stress of poverty. And that is a problem. So, oh, this one's so long too. I found a really interesting piece about Melissa Meyer, who is the CEO of Yahoo. And she's been held up in some ways for she built a private nursery for her kid close to her workplace so that she could go back and forth. She's kind of one of the people who's pointed to by traditional, by some so-called feminist folk who think that 50% CEOs being female is when feminism will have won, which is not my perspective on that. But it's a conversation about parenting, about women in the workplace, also being parents, in a way that never seems to be talked about when it's men, which is interesting considering generally, at least biologically, both of those people are part of the process. But this is a piece called Melissa Meyer, The Family and Capitalism by Tithi Bhattacharya on Socialist Worker. And it's really good, but I don't know how much time. I'll just read a little chunk of it and share the rest of it so that you can read it, because it is interesting. She talks about Meyer's decision to ban workers from being able to work from home. Okay, here, I have to back up, actually. This is from March 14th, 2013, and it's about Melissa Meyer, as I said, the CEO of Yahoo. And Tithi Bhattacharya says, "A young mother is building a nursery near her office at work so that she can be close to her infant while still being able to do her job. This should be welcome news for all working mothers as a model that needs to be adopted at all workplaces, but not according to this particular mother herself. Marissa Meyer, the CEO of Yahoo, a company currently worth $20 billion, is the mother in question, and alongside creating this private nursery for her own child, thus combining parenting and work as the boss of the company, she has decreed that no Yahoo employees may work from home. It goes without saying that for any employee parents, there will be no purpose-built, fully staffed nurseries attached to their work cubicles. Meyer's decision to ban workers from being able to work from home goes to the heart of the debates around women's liberation. How important is class in shaping gender? Why is it so hard for the vast majority of us to combine domestic labor, including parenting, and workplace labor? How can someone like Meyer, who clearly understands the need to combine the two kinds of labor, turn around and ban that possibility for her employees? We need to be engaged with two questions that come together here. One is the arena of production, where the ruling class agenda revolves around austerity. The other is the arena of reproduction, where the battle is being waged both legally, new laws to restrict reproductive rights, and attacks on government programs that are part of the social wage, and ideologically, victim blaming in cases of sexual assault, further sexualization of female bodies, homophobia and transphobia, and so on. We need to be committed to fighting on both fronts and to rejuvenate and revive discussions about how production and reproduction are related to each other. She continues into this next section. Home and work form the two opposing poles of our lives that seem never to work in harmony. Why are we constantly torn between finding time for our family and completing a project at work, or feeling guilty about not picking up a sick child from school because our boss refused to give us a break? Marissa Meyer's own set of reproductive choices is a perfect embodiment of the problem. Early last year, while announcing her pregnancy, Meyer also said, quote, "My maternity leave will be a few weeks long, and I'll work throughout it," end quote. Immediately, the mainstream press jumped in to support Meyer's commitment to productivity. The Wall Street Journal's Allison Lichter worried a little if Meyer's decision would inspire HR departments and heads of businesses to begin to expect other mothers to give up maternity leave. But she rallied right back to say that, in the end, Meyer can choose to be any kind of mother she wants, and those choices are none of anyone's business except Meyer, her husband, and her baby. Stu Friedman at the Huffington Post had no such equivocations, declaring Meyer to be a harbinger of social change. I don't know for sure what kind of prenatal and postnatal care Meyer received, but with her net worth of approximately $300 million and an annual base salary of $1 million, I would hazard a guess that she had adequate medical support and care. But what's significant is that even for a person such as Meyer, the work-family conflict did not magically dissolve, i.e. her baby did not grow into a teenager during her brief time away from the physical location of work so that he could be left home alone without parental supervision. Meyer's solution to the problem was the correct one, to bring the baby to work and provide him with stellar care. Imagine how you would feel as a working parent if your infant or child was in the same building as you, being looked after by a highly qualified team of caregivers while you worked. What Meyer did as a boss was precisely to block this possibility for her employees by banning workers from working from home. Whew, so I'm just going to continue because this is really good, and it really gets to the root of a lot of what I want to close with. At the root of this work versus home conflict is the fact that the U.S. has one of the most family-hostile set of public policies in the world, which forces people to fit into what could be called a degendered or gender-blind workplace. For example, the U.S. is one of four countries on the entire planet that lacks any paid maternity leave. The other three countries are Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. But if public policy makes it hard for women and parents to have full-time jobs, how do those policies then treat women who stay home to be full-time homemakers and parents? In this, too, the U.S. remains the worst industrialized country for women to be living outside the traditional economic sphere. Levels of maternal and child poverty are much higher here than in Europe. So, the very notion, I'm going to skip forward slightly. Again, I'm going to post this whole article for your reading pleasure in the podcast notes. The very notion of a rigid work schedule forms the primary framework of the problem. Having a work schedule isn't connected to human biology, the natural seasons, or, as liberals like to believe, individual preferences. A typical schedule for workers is determined by their company's relationship to the market and its need to maintain and increase profits. So, that is the heart of what I wanted to get to here. In this lovely article, Tithi Bhattacharya in The Socialist Worker, I will be posting the whole thing in the podcast notes, which you can find with the podcast tomorrow on the Praxis show page at kyrs.org. Also on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio. But as she points out here, the market has no vested interest in meeting human need. So a lot of, as we talked about at the beginning of the hour, a lot of this trauma that children are going through that's affecting their ability to learn and grow It's affecting people in all generations beyond that's ability to learn and grow and just be functional humans, comes from living in poverty, living in unnatural conditions. And I think it's definitely arguable and hopefully clear to many people that this economic system, capitalism, that we've been operating under is highly unnatural for humans. We are, our work, our home are segregated from one another. Our social lives have shrunk over past decades to the point where most socialization that happens online. It isn't the same face-to-face interaction that we've had. That's not really a qualitative judgment. It's just an observation. There isn't really, there's some vestiges of this, our tribal past, you know, where you'd be surrounded permanently with basically an extended family who has a vested interest in caring for you and your children, because your children are the people who will be caring for their children and them. It's an interdependent society rather than this hierarchy, which even with a woman on top of it, sorry, liberal, capitalist, feminists, even with a woman on top of the hierarchy, it's still a hierarchy and it still hurts children, primarily women, children, men, everyone. So how do those economic systems form the very trauma that we're concerned with here? And how can we quit that? So that's a primary question. You know, I also wanted to talk about war and imperialism today, talk about the ongoing trauma of growing up somewhere like Gaza is the example I'm most familiar with, and I had some resources on that, but the hour has flown by. So again, hopefully this has been taught you something you didn't know before. I guess I learned a lot, and I'm really excited to continue this month of education themed shows together. I'm always open for your feedback. Facebook.com/PraxisRadio. You can also call 747-3807, or you can email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, @kyrs.org. I will be back next week with a panel on higher ed, and yeah, I'm pretty available to talk to and for show suggestions. So thanks so much for listening. I'm going to outro with a very nice song by the band Coda called Limnos. It's a song that I think really embodies being a little kid. And I will thank Chris for the introduction to it. So thanks so much for listening. FES is up next. And I will be back next Saturday at 4 p.m. Look for the podcast at kyrs.org. By finding Praxis in the program list and finding the archive at the show page there. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your weekend. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.